The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Is Jerusalem about to become the next city to slip into a permanent state of conflict? 8 Israelis have been killed in about 30 attacks this month, mostly carried out by Palestinians armed with knives, although a few cases have involved guns. At least 18 suspects have been killed at the scene. In clashes with Israeli security forces this month, more than 20 Palestinians have been fatally shot. Many of the attacks have been perpetrated by Palestinian residents of East Jerusalem, and more than half have taken place inside the city. Is this a deliberate tactic or an inevitable consequence of a diplomatic stalemate between the Palestinians and the Israelis, while the rest of the Middle East swirls with violence? Daniel Levy served as a Middle East peace negotiator under Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. He's now the director of the Middle East and North Africa program at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He says there's a new episode opening in Israel.
I think it's premature to call this a third intifada. Anyway, the word intifada is used to describe quite different events. The first intifada in the late 80s was largely unarmed. The second intifada was far more of an armed escalation of violence. This one, if it develops, is likely to take a different course again from what we've seen in previous rounds. And if I may add, you know, one of the saddest things, John, is that if you look at the history of the conflict in recent decades, only after rounds of violence have we seen any kind of Israeli willingness to rethink and pursue something that approximates withdrawal and peace. I hope it won't take another round of violence for that to happen again.
In Israel, of course, there is this patchwork of, one Palestinian city next to an Israeli settlement. And in Israel proper, there are, Arabs and Israelis living side by side in places like Haifa. And then you have Jerusalem, which is almost like a theme park of split personality, a city that is two places in one place. Many of the violent acts of the last few weeks have taken place in East Jerusalem or in the Old City. Is it possible for the Palestinians or for some uprising to create a generalized chaos in Jerusalem that would become the alarm bell that gets the international community to pay attention?
No, it's a very important and interesting point that you raise. East Jerusalem, including what were 29 Palestinian villages that pre-1967 and Israel's taking of all of Jerusalem, they weren't even considered part of municipal Jerusalem. That entire area was annexed formally by Israel, something not done in the West Bank. That annexation is considered illegal under international law. It is not recognized internationally, not by the US or others. But what it also means is that having annexed East Jerusalem, Israel chose not to invest, not to even to attempt to create the veneer of treating the annexed Palestinians of East Jerusalem in any kind of equal way to other Israelis. It also means that the Palestinian Authority, of course, does not have a footprint, is not allowed by Israel to act in East Jerusalem. So in the West Bank, you still have security cooperation. That's not relevant in East Jerusalem. So it is, especially with the growth of Jewish settlements inside Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem, it is this real tinderbox. And as you say, it's that is most at the front line of exploding right now. What Israel has done so far is to begin to carry over more of the measures that it uses in the West Bank into East Jerusalem. More checkpoints on Palestinian neighborhoods, more closures, more stop and search. The very things that have caused Palestinians to be even more desperate and even more humiliated are now being seen increasingly in East Jerusalem. And the worry is that, yes, we will see Jerusalem as an epicenter and a Jerusalem in which the populations most intermingle as the epicenter of what could be, and we're not there, and I hope we don't get there, but what could be a whole new unraveling. And one of the interesting things is that this time around, it seems that Palestinians in Gaza, Palestinians in the West Bank, Palestinians in East Jerusalem, and Palestinians inside Israel, all of whom live under different regimes and varying degrees of inequality, are making more common cause than they have done in recent outbursts.
Talking about the potential for Jerusalem to become something of a conflict zone, Daniel Halevi has served as Middle East peace negotiator under Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. He's now the director of the Middle East and North Africa program at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Always great to talk to you, Daniel.
Good to talk to you, John. Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like marketing, meditation, and metalworking. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
The word on the streets in Afghanistan is that U.S. troops need to stay even longer than the pledge President Obama spoke about last week. The reluctant warrior Obama, some Afghans believe, is unwilling to do what is necessary to achieve a sustainable political solution. Will the government of Afghanistan ever be able to hold back the Taliban on its own? Waheed Manawi is an Afghan-American civil engineer and PhD candidate at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. He's doubtful. Waheed, welcome.
Hello, John.
What do you make of the extension of the president's commitment to Afghanistan, and what is the mission now? It's very, very hard for me to decipher.
According to most people I have talked to in Afghanistan, the friends and family that I have there, they actually look at it as a very good thing, because with the extension of the U.S. troops in Afghanistan, all the worries that they had of provinces falling to the Taliban, for example, the one in Kunduz that fell about 2 weeks ago, that will not be happening. The U.S. government and the U.S. military in Afghanistan provides a lot of air support in training to the Afghans. So if they leave there, the Afghans are worried that that will not be there anymore, and they will not get any air support. The training that is ongoing in Afghanistan will not be happening anymore, and the Afghan government is going to get weaker and weaker, and we're going to see a repeat of the early 90s when the Russians left. And there was this huge civil war that ensued. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed during that time. So that's the fear in the country now. And with the extension, a lot of people are happy that they are actually seeing more commitment from the U.S. In the short term, they want the presence to continue until they find a solution somehow so that the Afghans couldn't stand on their own feet.
Do you agree with the American generals who suggest that this is almost an open-ended commitment, that 2017 is not even close to how long this is going to take?
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. Right now, we are seeing this newly emergent Daesh or ISIS in Afghanistan, also in addition to Pakistan. 2 years' time is not enough time to deal with that phenomenon that's newly emerging in the country. They are saying that the U.S. has been there for 14 years. So another 2 years is nothing, especially now that the situation has gotten worse. So what they are saying is that there should not only be a military presence, but also political pressure on the neighboring countries, especially Pakistan, to solve the situation. But 2017 doesn't seem to be acceptable to almost anybody there.
Although the U.S. Invaded Afghanistan to get the Taliban out and to keep Afghanistan from being a nation that would be a home to terrorists, it sounds like what you're saying, that Afghanistan isn't even close to that. I mean, the entire 14-year mission has been a complete failure. I mean, there's a good argument for staying, as you say, but it still means that what the U.S. had intended has not been achieved at all.
Well, in terms of kicking the Taliban out and securing the country, that certainly hasn't happened. There has been a lot of economic development in the country. When you go to Kabul City now, it's a whole new city. And when you go to a lot of the provinces, you know, the economy has grown tremendously. But in terms of, you know, the initial mission that was kicking the Taliban out, that certainly is not true now, because they are becoming more and more powerful. The fewer U.S. troops there are, you know, the worse the situation gets there. What is frustrating a lot of Afghans is the U.S. support economic aid to Pakistan, which trickles down to the Taliban, according to the National Director of Security of the country. You know, that's what's frustrating them, that you're here to help us, but on the other hand, you're helping the country that supports the Taliban.
Waheed Manawi is an Afghan-American civil engineer and PhD candidate at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. Thank you so much, Waheed.
Thank you, John.
So here's something that sounds like a scandal. In the middle of a drought emergency, a rich corporation is found to be pumping millions of gallons of water each year from the federally owned San Bernardino National Forest with an expired permit to produce its own brand of bottled water that it sells for a profit. When the CEO of this company was asked if they would stop doing this during this state of emergency drought, the CEO said, absolutely not. In fact, if I could increase it, I would. The company is Nestle's. The brand of water is Arrowhead, and now three environmental groups are suing the U.S. Forest Service for allowing Nestle to use a permit that expired in 1988 to draw water from the parched state. Joining us with more is Eddie Kurtz, is executive director of the California-based Courage Campaign, one of the plaintiffs in this case. Eddie Kurtz, welcome.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So why isn't this more of a scandal?
Well, I think it is a scandal, and the press is really catching on to it now. We first alerted the world to this last spring, and over 600,000 people signed an online petition asking Nestle to stop doing this. Of course, they didn't. As you just pointed out, they sort of threw it back in our faces and said they would take more if they could. The State Water Board did nothing either, and so we decided it's up to us to stand up to these bullies.
Now, Nestle's isn't dumping this water on golf courses. I mean, it is being actually drunk by people who need to drink water. So, I mean, that's the purpose of water, right?
Yeah, and water is a great thing to drink in lieu of other things like soda, et cetera. But you know what? You got tap water. Tap water is actually pretty much the same thing as bottled water, and it comes right out of your tap, and it's a lot cheaper. And as much as possible, we encourage people to drink tap water.
Is there any evidence that the bottling of Arrowhead water impedes the production of tap water coming out of the San Bernardino National Forest?
No, I don't think it really does. What it does do, though, is it is having dramatic impacts in the environment there, the frogs, the fish. Already, I mean, this drought is the worst drought in 500 years at least. That's what the scientists have said. Water is a scarce commodity in California, and the species living in the San Bernardino National Forest are suffering because Nestle wants to make a profit.
So it's more the wildlife than the people who are living in Southern California in this particular case.
In this case, yeah. But we do know that literally 56% of the permits, over 500 permits in California owned by bottled water corporations, are expired. They're not current, meaning that there hasn't been environmental review looking in. Does this make sense? Can this environment withstand this water bottling? That isn't happening in 56% of the cases, and that's millions and millions and millions of gallons of water.
But it's mostly being drunk in California, yes?
Mostly, but not all.
Doesn't that complicate your case? I mean, it's one thing to talk about golf courses and lawns and celebrities with their fountains. It's quite another to say that a company can't sell the water that people want. I mean, I guess the alternative would be to have it be free out of the tap. How complicated is this lawsuit?
Well, it's actually not that complicated. I mean, you know, and to your question, I mean, consumer demand drives a lot of things that aren't good, and we don't always follow consumer demand and let them have, let them have whatever they want. In this case, the case is not complicated. The permit's been expired since 1988. There's even questions as to whether Nestle has the water rights to this water. So it's been almost 30 years since government agency has reviewed whether this makes sense. For some reason, they've been able to continue doing it by paying $500 a year. That's the story they've told in the press. As long as they continue paying their permit, the Forest Service hasn't stopped them. But our lawyers dug into it, and they said this makes no sense. Based on precedent, this shouldn't still be happening. So we actually think our legal case is pretty straightforward.
Sounds like you're scared to go after Nestle since you're going after the Forest Service.
Well, it's just legally you need to go after the Forest Service because they're enabling Nestle. But we're not scared of Nestle at all. In the spring, we did on-the-ground protests at their various plants across the state. I'd debate the president of Nestle, the CEO, anytime.
All right. Well, let's do it on this show, shall we?
I'm in.
Eddie Kurtz is executive director of the California-based Courage Campaign, all about water in California. Thanks so much, Eddie.
Thanks, John.
Earlier in the hour, we heard an Afghan pleading for the United States to stay the course in his country. And last week, a woman who ran a humanitarian program for the women of Afghanistan said U.S. troops were the only thing keeping her country from slipping into the barbaric clutches of the Taliban.
Please, President Obama, members of the Congress, do the needful to safeguard the progress that has been so hard won in Afghanistan over the last 14 years. We have to make sure that the country is strong before we step down.
Sunita Vishwanath, the co-founder of Women for Afghan Women. The president has taken political credit for saying back in 2013 that the brave American men and women in uniform are coming home from Afghanistan. That's not quite the same as saying mission accomplished. And with the opium poppy harvest near record levels, setbacks in Kunduz that have driven women out, and fear of the Afghan government, the Taliban, and now ISIS, there is still enough mission for the president to say last week that some troops would be staying until 2017. Amy Bontrager and her family will be part of accomplishing that mission. Her husband, Mason, an infantryman, has deployed 5 times, twice to Iraq, 3 times to Afghanistan. And with a new baby sitting on her lap, Amy told me that her family's mission is raising a new generation of military families in unprecedented circumstances.
We're definitely facing this reality of what it looks like to raise children in this lifestyle. I've said before, we could be the first generation that is going to experience 20 years of deployment and what that's like to raise a family. We have nothing to compare to. And so we're learning as we go, but we also rely heavily on support of our country so that we continue to serve this mission.
But it's difficult. I mean, I can hear it in your voice. This is, you know, looking towards the future and what this deployment open-ended means. It's easy for a general to say, not so easy for a mom.
Yeah, you can't take the reality that deployments are challenging and it's hard. And each time he goes, the uncertainties. But we both realize this is what it looks like to serve our country in today's military. And we have to accept that mission. And I know my husband, as well as a large number of others, stand ready. And they want to go back. They started this war at the beginning, and they're ready to hopefully successfully complete the mission in the next year.
Are you all in for that mission?
I think we have to accept that mission because that's the mission that's been given to us by our commander in chief. This is very new to millennials. In 2001, did we think we would still be at war? That probably wasn't even a thought. But this is our reality. So we realize that the mission is much greater than us, but we stand ready to serve. And that's what it means to be in the military today. You have to be ready for what the mission that is given.
This is something, as you've said, millennials spending essentially huge chunks of their lifetime at war. Kids, moms, dads, and then, of course, the losses that come from, you know, if anything happens. Why do you have to figure this out on your own?
We don't necessarily have to figure it out on our own. We've come a long way over the last 12 years of what is out there to support military families. And that's one area I'm really excited that I've been able to give back to military families for the organization I work with, Blue Star Families. They serve military families, but they even have a near program for neighbors, maybe families that don't know anyone in the military, but they want to give back. They want to help. And through Blue Star Families, you can become a member, a neighbor, and find ways to support these military families that are continuing to serve our country. So I feel there is a lot more out there, and there's a lot of work to be done, but we do have support, but we're going to need to continue to need that support.
Do you ever talk to Mason about maybe, you know, we've done our bit. It's time for us to move on. We shouldn't be in this shadow of danger for years and years and years.
I think that's a conversation that happens in a lot of homes. And I think day to day it changes. Do you stay in? Do you get out? But it goes back to that commitment. And you realize for some of these guys, they feel they're called to do this. This is what they are built for and they've trained for. It's hard. You look at these children and you think this is a very different lifestyle that they are being brought up in. To other children in our country, but then you realize it's something, it goes back to, it's much greater than us.
Amy Bontrager is a military spouse. Her husband has been deployed 5 times, and she's the program manager for the nonprofit Blue Star Families that supports military families. Take care.
Thank you so much for your time.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
2.2 million men and women are behind bars in America, most of them parents. 1 in 5 of those male inmates owes child support. The payments, you see, just accumulate during their incarceration, and so by the time many inmates are released, they can owe tens of thousands of dollars. The Obama administration is trying to change all this by authorizing new rules that could help imprisoned parents halt the accumulation of support and offer a reduction in what they owe. It will take a complicated reworking of the rules requiring changing child support designations. And here to explain is Eli Hager, a reporter with the Marshall Project who focused on this problem in a joint project with The Washington Post. Eli, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is just one of the big social problems that is a consequence of having 2.2 million people incarcerated, right?
Certainly.
And when you say it's complicated, what sort of unraveling has to be done to make the child support go away or less of a problem?
Well, there's a couple of steps. First of all, most states consider incarceration to be voluntary impoverishment. In other words, it's the parents' own fault for getting themselves locked up and losing their income. So they shouldn't be able to get off the hook for child support because of that. So if you want to do something about this child support debt that accumulates, you have to first stop calling incarceration voluntary impoverishment. But then it's even more complicated after that because parents still have to be notified of their right to change the amount they're paying, and they have to file for that change of amount themselves, often from prison, which involves filing all sorts of paperwork without a lawyer, without access to the courts. So it can be incredibly difficult to get a reduction in the child support payment they owe, even if they technically do have the right.
Brandon Jones, you had how much child support when you left prison?
When I left prison, I actually had less than I had before I went in, but I had about, you know, roughly close to maybe $3,000 to $4,000, maybe kind of debt stacked up there.
So it was a significant debt.
Yes, sir.
Brandon Jones is a former inmate and father. He's speaking to us from Philadelphia. What happened to your child when you went into prison?
Well, when I went into prison, you know, I was young. I was like 19 years old. And my child was at the point where, you know, he was already maybe, you know, 3 to 4, close to 5 years old. And his mother was actually on welfare at the time, you know, which is why, you know, how, you know, my child support order had got started. You know, by me not being there, you know, he lost, obviously, you know, that a lot of that early connection with his father. And I was like a hands-on dad before my incarceration. And, you know, now instead of him getting from both parents, he had to just depend on whatever the state would award mom to help take care of them until she could go back out on her own and find, you know, new employment, which made his quality of life go down drastically.
What do you think the impact is on the inmates when they come out facing this debt, and how urgent is it for them to pay back as a way of starting their new life?
Well, there's a huge impact of this debt on inmates as they return to society. Oftentimes, if they do get a job, which is incredibly difficult with a criminal record, as we've been learning in the past few months and years, up to 65% of their paychecks are garnished, which is a huge amount, and it discourages formal employment and encourages people to go back to making money in the underground economy as a way of supporting themselves and their families. And they're also often re-prosecuted because they have $10,000, $20,000 in arrears, and oftentimes local DAs will prosecute them for child support nonpayment or for contempt of court. And they might even see themselves back in jail for debt that accumulated while they were inside. Another thing that happens is suspension of their driver's license, which is another thing that is a barrier to getting to work and to maintaining stable employment. So there's a number of consequences for parents who accumulated debt while inside on the way out.
It seems as though you're in a cycle when you're released from prison that is very, very dangerous.
Yes, sir.
What do you do about that? Who do you blame for that?
Well, I have to personally blame myself, you know, for my actions. And then not only that, you know, I've changed my life drastically. You know, now here I am. I'm a award winner. I'm a, you know, black male engagement leader. I work at a multimillion-dollar firm downtown. But guess what? I still got those arrearages, and every month I still have to report down to family court, even though that order is not still in place. I'm still paying off those arrearages from when I got out of prison, even though I had a lot of them remitted because I actually, my mother, you know, learned some things while I was inside that helped me in some paperwork process, which most men don't know. But at the end of the day, it's my fault. I made the decision, and I actually put myself in a position where the system could actually come in and do what it is that they want to me. And I'm still suffering from that, no matter how great my life is, you know, to this day.
In terms of 2.2 million people in jail, I mean, these social consequences need something other than just the good attitudes of people like Brandon Jones to turn this around. I mean, the child support needs to be paid. These are really difficult problems.
I think they are really difficult problems that we need to grapple with as a whole community. And I think one thing that's interesting about Brandon's story is that, as he said, his child support order was generated because the mother of his child went on welfare. So any child support that he pays doesn't actually go to his family. It goes to the state as repayment for that welfare. And I think a lot of people don't understand that. A lot of this debt that fathers come out of prison with, if they pay some portion of it or all of it, often it doesn't actually go to the family. It goes to the state as repayment for welfare that the mother received while the father was inside. So child support in its origins is actually a cost recovery program for the state. The state decided that it didn't want to be paying so much welfare to poor mothers and children. And so I think that adds an interesting dynamic to what happened with Brandon in terms of understanding our responsibility as a community, perhaps to provide for these families without asking for tens of thousands of dollars from the father.
So, Brandon, what do you think? Should the state have some responsibility here since the incarceration does break up families? Or, hey, it's just your fault, pal. Sorry, you know, you're going to have to deal with it.
I mean, you really got to look at it from both sides. I mean, when you look at the state's perspective, I mean, no, of course, it's not fair. You know, men should not be making, you know, the type of mistakes to actually take them away from their family. But in the United States, you know, there are things set up, you know, in the event that there are disasters in the family, if there are a shortage of, you know, fathers in the family because of the mass incarceration, you know, complex we're dealing with. So I don't say it's fair on both sides, you know, but at the end of the day, somebody has a job to do. And if men are incarcerated, you know, I think that it's not fair that their arrears, you know, stack up to the point where they can't come back from once they are, you know, let back into society.
Is there any initiative to change things?
Well, there are these new Obama regulations, which would do a number of things. The main purpose is just to modernize the child support system overall in terms of automating it. But one of the things it would do is end this voluntary impoverishment label. And so fathers in all 50 states or non-custodial parents in all 50 states would have the right to get a downward reduction in their child support while they're in prison. And it would also help fathers who are in arrears from being in prison get jobs and find jobs after the fact as an alternative to re-prosecuting them and pursuing them.
Eli Hager is a reporter for the Marshall Project who wrote a story in conjunction with the Washington Post on child support and inmates who owe child support when they leave prison. Brandon T. Jones is a former inmate and father. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Did you go to college? Did you get financial aid? Did you pay a full load, full ride? The president wants to make the first 2 years of community college free. Do you have a degree? If so, was it worth the time and money?
My name is Laura from New Jersey. My college degree was worth my time, but not my money. If community college became free, I would absolutely go back to school to change professions. But right now, I can't afford it, and I feel trapped.
Orlando, Florida. Yes, I have a bachelor's and a master's. Education is important for career building, but also building knowledge, experience, tolerance, and life skills. And education is priceless. Well, that's a bargain. What do you think? Is a degree worth the time and money? We're going to be assessing that all week long here on The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.